relax, asking her to talk to Maven, but I'd need to wait until after sundown to hear back, and it sounded like whatever was happening would start at nightfall. But I did know a few other people. I'll make some calls, I promised Kirsten. We agreed to meet in another 2 hours to pool our findings. As soon as I hung up, I opened an email on my phone. It's hard to reach out in the old world because it's so much like Fight Club and because it's not organized into governments or anything. There are no embassies, no tourism boards. It's sort of a feudal system meets the Wild West kind of scenario, which makes it hard to communicate in the modern world. You can't just Google nulls in Japan and get anywhere. About 5 years ago, however, my former mentor and fellow null, and, as it turned out, psycho hose beast, Olivia, had made a concentrated effort to find other nulls. I never really got all the details, but she managed to dig up 5 more of us. 2 in Europe, 1 in Japan, 1 in Russia, and Jameson, who was now dead. It was one of the only useful, non-evil things she'd ever done, and I'd inherited all the contact information after her death. I didn't have much of a relationship with most of them. We had all needed to pledge loyalty to some faction or another, which made us wary of each other. But years ago, when Olivia was threatening Jack, I'd gotten desperate. I'd sent him to spend a few days with a Scottish null named Reese. I hadn't actually spoken to Reese on the phone since then, but we sent the occasional email just to check in and, well, make sure the other was still alive. Mostly it was him making sure I was still alive. He had the most normal life of any null I'd ever heard of. He was in his 40s, and he and his wife had adopted a couple of children, now in their early teens. Reese lived in a fairly small town that didn't have much of an old world presence, so he worked a day job as a carpenter and only did null stuff when called upon. I got the impression from him that this rarely happened, partly because there were no werewolves in the British Isles. Because of the Luparii. He was obviously the right person to ask about this. I did the math, determined that it was only early evening there, and placed the call. I would have called either way, but at least I didn't have to apologize for waking him up. The phone rang twice, and as soon as I said hello, a thick Scottish brogue said,
"Scarlet Bernard, lass, what's the matter now? Are you sending Jack my way again?"
That gave me pause. Hi, Reese. Why do you think something's the matter?
Oh, because you only call me when your world's fallen in. What is it this time?
I'd been planning to ease in with some small talk, but hey. The Wild Hunt, I said, as evenly as I could manage. There was a long silence, and I checked the phone's screen to make sure the call hadn't dropped. Reese?
Aye, I'm here.
Do you know anything about it, beside the Grimm Brothers folklore and the stuff on the Wikipedia page?
I know it's very old, and that it doesn't happen anymore, for which we should all be bleeding grateful, he said.
It's happening here, in L.A. Tonight, I think. He chuckled.
Someone is pulling your leg, lass. The spell for the Wild Hunt's been lost since...
Reese, the Luparii are here, I interrupted. I'm told they found the scroll. Another long silence. Then, in a shaken voice, he said,
"That's impossible."
I told him about Carl Schmidt and his flight from Europe.
"A Wild Hunt in the modern world,"
Reese said, sounding amazed, in an "oh no, we're all going to die" kind of way that made my stomach twist. "Why? What is it? There are hundreds of different stories and we can't figure out which are real." He sighed.
"It's a spell. A very, very old spell, likely predating Christianity. It forms a group of riders and their hounds into spectral warriors."
"Spectral warriors?" I repeated, because, come on.
I know how it sounds, But the Wild Hunt was how witches went to war against other Old World groups, including other witches. My own great-great-grandmother claims she heard the Wild Hunt go by once. She had nightmares about the blowing of the horn and the baying of the hounds to her dying day. It's evil magic, lass.
I thought magic wasn't inherently good or evil, I said.
Maybe it isn't, he amended. But this particular spell is evil. It alters a group of witches so that they cannot be killed or harmed. The full spell changes their hounds and horses and everything, so the riders are able to pass through structures and kill anyone with ties to magic.
Wait, that wasn't what I was expecting. Not humans?
No, humans can't even see it without special ointment. Only witches, werewolves, and vampires can see the hunt, and only they can fall victim to it. And it doesn't affect the physical world, other than the bodies of its victims. You say the Lupari came to Los Angeles to recover the scroll?
I believe so, yes.
All right.
Relief had crept into his voice.
You should still be okay. As long as they don't get the sword as well.
Oh, shit. About that, I began.
Scarlet, he groaned. Don't tell me they have the Durandal, too.
Okay, I won't. Unless Durandal is a magic glowing sword that can cut through anything. There was another long silence, and then I heard voices in the background, children and an adult woman. She must have asked who he was talking to because he said,
Hang on a minute, lass.
And then the phone was muffled. I had a bad feeling I needed to prioritize my questions. When Reese came back, I hurried to say, Reese, wouldn't Nulls be able to undo the Wild Hunt magic?
I don't rightfully know. The Wild Hunt spell predates us. But listen to me. I can't help you with this no more.
That brought me up short. What? Why not?
This is Scotland, girl, he said defensively. The Lupari have eyes and ears here.
I thought they were in France. Dashiell had also said Portugal and Romania, but I wanted separate confirmation. Reese groaned.
Their headquarters are in France, but they have outposts in England, Germany, Romania, and Portugal, he said. They need room out in the country to train the dogs. They know about me, but they think I'm nothing. Just a low-power null who picks up the occasional vampire job. If I get on the radar... I've got kids, Scarlet.
I closed my eyes.
Reese, can you just tell me... I can't. All I'll say, and I'll say it with the best of wishes for you. Get out of Los Angeles. Wherever the Wild Hunt is, don't be there.
And he hung up the phone. I looked at it for a minute, in amazement. Well, shit. Chapter 34. Kirsten hadn't wanted me to come to her house, not that I could blame her. Her place is warded all to hell against intruders, and if I stopped by, she'd have to redo all her defenses. Her daughter with Hain, Ophelia, was at the house too, and the last thing I wanted was to put a toddler in danger. We could have crashed at Dashiell's place, but Kirsten had apparently just redone all the wards there, too. Being a null is a pain in the ass sometimes. She and I debated it for a bit before deciding to meet somewhere non-warded. Kirsten had suggested a place called the Los Angeles River Visitor Center, which turned out to be a sort of half-park, half-museum, just northeast of Dodger Stadium. It consisted of fancy Spanish mission-style grounds, with rooms for conferences and a few exhibits on the history of the L.A. River. Mostly, it seemed like a really pretty place to have staged wedding photos, or catch Pokemon, or something. But I had to admit, it was pretty. All wrought iron fences and fountains and creeping ivy on stucco walls. As Shadow and I walked in, she probably wasn't allowed in there, but I'd wait for someone to yell at me. I saw a handful of people wandering around taking photos or chatting next to a large map of the LA River. For the most part, though, the place was pretty empty. Apparently, this was not a popular destination if there wasn't a wedding, which was probably why Kirsten had picked it. I'd texted Kirsten upon arriving, and she'd replied that she would meet me in a little side alcove. "You're early," she said with a frown, as Shadow and I rounded the corner. "I took your advice and called a null in Europe," I explained. "I have a little new information."
"Oh, goody," she said with a brittle smile.
"More information." She led me down an open-air corridor to a small building entrance. "One of my witches volunteers for the River Center," she said over her shoulder, pulling the exterior door open. We went through a short, wide hallway to an unmarked door. Kirsten knocked 5 times, and I heard a bolt slide over. Owen's face appeared in the crack.
"Scarlet!"
He swung the door wide. Then, to my surprise, he threw his arms around me for a moment. Almost immediately, he ducked away, embarrassed.
"I'm glad you guys made it," he mumbled.
The Bargist trotted over to him and inclined her head so he could scratch at her favorite spot, behind her furry ear. He obliged.
Thanks, I said, feeling a little guilty.
I hadn't really thought about it at the time, but it must have been really scary for Owen to escape the Luparii's clutches and then watch his would-be rescuers walk right into a Luparii trap. But now we were both obviously desperate to change the subject.
What's going on here?" I said, looking around.
The room turned out to be a surprisingly plush-looking conference space with one of those super-long tables. 3/4 of it was covered in papers and books, many of which looked old and kind of crumbly.
Oh.
This was why she'd made the joke about more information. "Owen has been helping me with research," Kirsten said simply.
"Where did you get all this?"
"Most of it was from my collection, but some of it came from Owen's grandfather." Kirsten gestured at an old-timey trunk lying open at the foot of the conference table.
"You took it from the crime scene?"
"Remember how I was helping my grandfather move?" Owen put in. "I'd already moved his trunk of Luparii stuff. I just went back over to the nursing home this morning and picked it up."
"Smart," I said.
Owen's face fell a little.
"Yeah, well, I think they were glad to get rid of his stuff. Make way for someone else."
"You were saying about talking to another null?" Kirsten reminded me.
"Yeah, Reese. He knew a little bit about the Wild Hunt spell. Like the name of the stupid magical sword," I offered.
"Durandal. Don't ask me how to spell it."
"No need," Kirsten said, sifting through one of the stacks. This one looked like regular computer printouts.
"I've heard that before."
"Here." She picked up a page. "Durandal was a sword of legend in France, mostly known for belonging to Roland, one of Charlemagne's famous knights." She shrugged. "I haven't seen it connected to the Wild Hunt, but there were rumors that Roland was a witch."
"Well, according to Reese, to run the Wild Hunt, you need the sword and a magic scroll. Maybe that's something we can use."
"I read about a scroll," Kirsten began, but her phone buzzed. She frowned down at the screen. "Hang on, Will is here. Let me go get him."
When she left the room, I turned to Owen, determined to try again.
I had my own shit going on, but this kid had been through a lot.
"How are you holding up?"
I asked.
He shrugged.
"It's just surreal, you know?"
So far that day, I had seen 2 people die, made out with my best friend, and said goodbye to my brother, possibly forever. And that was just today.
"Believe it or not," I told Owen, "I kind of do."
I let a moment of silence pass before adding cautiously, "It's good of you to help us with this."
He focused on petting Shadow, avoiding eye contact.
The way I see it is, stopping the Lupari is the only way I get my life back. I won't be safe until they're dead or gone.
Was there something he wasn't saying? So it's not about revenge?
That's the thing.
He looked at me then, and I realized that his brown eyes were terrified.
I'm from a long line of murderers and torturers, he said quietly. What if I like it?
That brought me up short, but only for a moment. Magical specialty isn't the same thing as destiny, kid. I know a boundary witch who could tell you all about that.
His eyes widened, but Will and Kirsten came through the door before he could respond. Will looked worried and haggard, wearing the same clothes as the day before.
How is Jesse's brother?
He asked me. I held up my phone. Jesse just texted. The doctors are putting him in a medically induced coma until the swelling goes down. They won't know anything else for a bit. I looked at Kirsten.
Is Hayne coming?
I asked. She shook her head.
He's staying with Ophelia, she said shortly. This is it, until Dashiell wakes up for the night.
Okay. I couldn't exactly blame her for wanting her husband to protect her kid. Besides, if what Rhys told me was true, they'd be safer together, away from anything supernatural.
Tell Will what you told us, Kirsten instructed me.
Right. I called my null friend in Scotland, I began, and this time I walked them through the whole conversation. Will looked surprised.
Hang on, he said. You're telling me the world's most powerful witch magic has been locked up for the last 50 years in an attic in Long Beach?
That's what I said, I exclaimed.
Has the spell always been with a Lupari?
Will asked.
I mean, they didn't actually invent it, did they?
Owen and Kirsten shook their heads. I've been speaking with my aunt about the scroll Owen mentioned, Kirsten said. It's fallen into the hands of any number of people over the centuries. It was even in Sweden at one point, which is partly why the spell is called different things in different countries. Owen looked through a stack of notes and pulled out the one he wanted.
In Germany, it was the Furious Host. In England, it was Woden's Hunt. Mesne de la Camp in France, and so on.
We think, Kirsten added, looking at Will, the Lupari got a hold of the scroll shortly after Charlemagne asked them to kill werewolves. The Wild Hunt may have been how the Lupari originally cleared Europe. They used it to kill werewolves for around 300 years. Then, in the early 20th century, one of the Lupari witches decided that the Wild Hunt magic was too powerful and destructive, and they hid it away. She went on. I can't find any evidence of it having been used since then.
So how did your grandfather find it?
Will asked Owen reasonably. Owen puffed his cheeks full of air, then blew it out.
Okay, well, during World War II, a bunch of the Lupari men signed up to fight for the Nazis.
Of course they did, I muttered.
And as they traveled around Europe, they kept finding signs of werewolves. They were pissed. When the war ended, all any of them could think about was how to cleanse Europe of the werewolves again.
Owen was fidgeting, and I realized he'd skipped this part of the story earlier, when he'd talked to Jesse and me. Or maybe we just hadn't had enough time for him to get to it. We had kind of rushed off to save Noah.
Just tell us, I commanded.
You asked me why I never bugged my grandpa about the scroll, Owen said in a rush. It's because he was so obviously ashamed of belonging to a family that had willingly joined up with the Nazis. His own father, my great-grandfather, I guess, was a soldier. My grandpa was still a kid when his dad got back, maybe 13 or 14, but he was really smart.
Grandpa wanted to impress his dad, this badass soldier, so he threw himself into research. And he found the scroll. It had been hidden in some German library for almost 40 years. Kirsten rested a hand lightly on Owen's shoulder, which surprised me for a second. But then again, Kirsten's whole job was taking care of wayward witches. I felt a little spark of hope. Maybe if we all survived this, Owen could actually join her group, if that was what he wanted. The touch seemed to give Owen courage. Grandpa didn't tell me what the spell was about, but he did say he showed it to Werner. That was his father's name. Werner was super happy. He told Grandpa how proud he was. But then later, Grandpa overheard the Lupari discussing what they were going to do with the spell, and he realized what a terrible mistake he'd made. That night, he stole the scroll and ran all the way to Los Angeles, where no one would ever think to look for him.
He didn't give you any details about this part?
Will asked, looking frustrated.
What they were going to do with the spell?
Owen shook his head, looking miserable. Kirsten took over the story. But from what we've been able to find, it looks like Werner didn't just drop the matter, even when Carl couldn't be found, she said. Werner was an active Lupari witch, and although he couldn't replicate the full Wild Hunt spell without the scroll, he was able to recreate one small part of it. They already had plenty of dogs, because even after the scroll was lost, they kept training dogs to hunt werewolves.
Wait, you lost me. Which part of the spell? I said, like an idiot, because it was so obvious.
Kirsten gave me a pitying look. The hounds, she said softly, her eyes dropping down to shadow.
Werner used his knowledge of the scroll to recreate the Bargest spell.
Chapter 35. I completely tuned out the conversation then, as the size of this whole thing threatened to overwhelm me. You know that feeling when you're watching a TV show and they air a flashback that suddenly makes the last 5 episodes fit together in a new way, and it's so obvious that you're mad at yourself? And simultaneously impressed with the people who made the show? That's exactly how I felt in that moment, because it had been practically staring me in the face. 3 years earlier, when the Lupari had first come to Los Angeles and I had learned about their anti-werewolf efforts, I'd wondered how they had managed to clear all the wolves out of mainland Europe. Our best source, Sashi's mother, Dr. Noring, had known a little about the history. How the ancient Lupari had spent hundreds of years using Barghests to control the werewolf population, meaning they used a Barghest to hunt and kill any werewolves who tried to enter their territory. That made sense once I'd met Shadow, but I'd never understood the logistics of getting all the werewolves out of Europe to begin with. You wouldn't be able to control more than a few Barghests at a time. And even with a handful of them, how could one group cover enough ground to clear that much area? But if they'd initially used the Barghests as a part of the Wild Hunt, a massive hunting party of legend that would keep supernatural creatures away by fear alone, it made so much more sense. I'd just never made the connection between the Barghest and the Wild Hunt, mostly because the folklore I'd found didn't necessarily reflect it. But I should have realized that at some point, the legends must have gotten twisted up. After all, it wasn't exactly the first time that had happened. Just as the Wild Hunt had different names, so did the Barghests. I'd seen Shadow's kind referred to as devil dogs, black shucks, hellhounds, and about 6 more. The only reason I used Barghest was because it carried the least amount of negative connotation. Then it sank in how screwed we now were. This was about more than an evil witch clan, or even the Barghest spell. The frickin' Wild Hunt was real, and it could be used to hunt and kill the people of the old world, right here in Los Angeles. No wonder Reese had told me to leave town. I felt panic clawing at my chest,
and then Shadow reached over and took my hand in her mouth, biting down just a tiny bit. I jumped, looking down at her. She wagged her clubbed-off tail at me, then lay down on her back and put her paws in the air, asking for a belly rub. I blinked. She'd only ever done this when the two of us were alone, because showing your belly is a sign of weakness. But she wanted to remind me that, at the end of the day, she was real. A creature of legend, maybe, but real. I smiled and leaned over in my chair so I could scratch her tummy. I tuned back into the conversation. Owen was saying, "It wasn't famous until Jakob Grimm wrote about it in 1835, but most scholars believe that it predates Christianity." "Rhys thinks it predates Nulls," I put in.
"Does that mean you can't stop it?"
Will asked. I shrugged. The Lupari seem to think that I can, hence their deep and thorough commitment to killing me. But I don't really know. "You've dealt with magical objects before," Kirsten reminded me. "The Transrua was powerful, and you zapped that." "True," I conceded. "But the Transrua was a witch spell. It came from a conduit. What if the Wild Hunt spell comes from a time before conduits, from creatures that came before?" Will stared at me.
"Are you talking about fairies? Actual fairies?"
"It's not impossible," Kirsten said thoughtfully. "We've all seen enough of the Wild Hunt stories to know it was usually connected to the Fae, and there have always been rumors that conduits weren't the first magical creatures. So, why not?" I had kind of hoped the others would contradict me.
"Well, shit,"
I said, which seemed to sum up the feelings of pretty much all of us.
"So, we don't know if Scarlet can stop it,"
Will concluded.
"But what do we know? What actually happens?"
"According to Rhys, a group of witches, their horses, and their hounds, or barguests, turn into spectral warriors," I informed him, "who can kill supernaturals. But he says the spell doesn't affect humans. They can't even see what's going on without a special ointment on their eyes, which we don't have."
"How do their riders make the distinction?"
Will said doubtfully.
"When I run as a wolf, I can only tell people apart by smell."
"The riders only see witches, vampires, and werewolves, like they're wearing special heat imaging goggles," Kirsten explained. I pictured a cat and a whole room full of mice. "And they kill everything they see. When the Lupari first used the spell, I'm guessing they called and warned the vampires and friendly witches about their route beforehand." "How do we stop it?" I asked. Kirsten shook her head.
"According to all of this,"
she gestured at the table, "you can't. You can only run or hide and hope they pick someone else instead. If you hear the Oliphant blow, you're already too close."
"Oliphant?"
I said, confused. "I swear that's the name of an unreasonably attractive actor."
"It means horn,"
Owen said, miming blowing on his closed fist.
"It was a medieval instrument made from elephant tusks. The Wild Hunt uses at least one. When you hear it, it's a harbinger."
"What kind of damage are we talking about here?" I asked. "How many people can they kill?"
"Theoretically,"
Kirsten said, "hundreds each night."
"Great. Just fucking great.
Can we evacuate?" I looked back and forth between her and Will. "I mean, I know Will's already been getting the pack out of town, but what if we just sent everybody out of L.A. County? No victims, no Wild Hunt." I kind of liked the idea of the Hunt riding around L.A. all frustrated because there was no one to kill. It would be like Spider-Man stuck in a meadow. Kirsten and Will exchanged a look. "For how long?" Kirsten said to me.
"And how will it look?"
"Seriously?" I said, surprised. That was the kind of question I expected from Dashiell. but I'd thought Kirsten cared more about her people than that. You're worried about optics?
I have to be, because they obviously are, she countered. The Lupari could have come to Long Beach, quietly killed Carl Schmidt, and returned to Europe with the scroll. No offense, she added to Owen, who shrugged. Instead, they are making this as big and splashy as they can. They want to look like they're putting us in our place. Have you thought about what happens if they succeed?
Oh. No, I hadn't, I admitted.
The Lupari have been collecting power in Europe, Will said quietly. They're expanding with terrifying speed. I can think of only one reason why they'd come here now.
Because we embarrassed them, I said, understanding. I thought of what I'd said to Jesse about how the old world saw peace as weak.
You did?
Owen asked, looking between me and the others.
When?
3 years ago, I answered. They sent a scout on a mission to check out the Nova Wolf, and we bitch-slapped her and stole the Barghest. No offense, I added to Shadow, who gave me a not-amused look.
Yes, we embarrassed them. And if they want to keep collecting power, they have to get a foothold in the United States,
Will put in.
Taking us down is the perfect way to do it. If we run and hide, we're giving them what they need.
But what do they want with all that territory? All that power? Kirsten pointed at me. Great question.
One we should be asking Dashiell,
Will reminded us. I don't disagree, Kirsten said. But I can't shake the feeling that waking up Dashiell and taking him out during the day might be exactly what they want. She was right. Unless there was imminent death on the line, I wasn't going to pull Dashiell out of the safety of his mansion. I checked my watch and groaned. How was it only noon? We've got 7 hours until sunset. What do you guys want to do? Will looked at Kirsten, and they exchanged some kind of complicated leadership look that I was glad I didn't have to interpret.
We evacuate the weakest among us,
Will said finally,
and prepare the strong to fight.
Chapter 36. That sounded suitably dramatic and all, but contacting all the city's witches and werewolves wasn't really something I could help with. What we needed to know was where the Luparii were now, although I'd settle for where they intended to start the wild hunt. Owen would keep doing his best with the book research. I had a different idea for how to spend my afternoon. Jesse wasn't going to like it much, but I had Shadow for backup, and the Barghest seemed to be spoiling for a fight. Will agreed to contact Astrid and make sure I could keep using her truck, promising to provide her with a spare vehicle if she needed it. While Shadow and I walked out to the parking lot, I called Jesse's cell phone, but there was no answer. He was probably talking to the doctor, or maybe Noah was out of surgery and had been moved to intensive care. I left him a voicemail, not sure if that was making it easier or harder for either of us. When people from other places talk about Los Angeles, they're really referring to the greater L.A. area, a massive territory that includes incorporated towns like Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, and Pasadena. It's all L.A. to someone from Michigan, but residents might actually take offense if you accuse them of living in L.A. when their actual home is within the Beverly Hills limits, and vice versa. I know, it's weird. Then again, most people in L.A. can't tell you the difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin, so whatever. But although Los Angeles is often a blanket term for places outside the city, San Pedro technically is within the L.A. city limits, though it's crowded by other cities on two sides and the ocean on a third. It's large and independent enough to be its own town. In fact, it used to be. But now it has something that L.A. wants. The port of Los Angeles, which brings like a million jobs into California. So San Pedro stays in the city limits, even if it requires some creative border drawing to make it so. And at the southern tip of the southernmost part of the city
lies a big chunk that fell into the water. I'd looked up Sunken City before leaving Kirsten and Will, and Jesse had been right. It was a condemned oceanfront area that had once contained a fancy new development, or however fancy developments got in the 1920s. At about 40,000 square feet, it wasn't even that big, but it was dangerous as hell. A bunch of people had died exploring the area, sometimes as many as 5 in 1 year. And yet, its location was still easily available on Google Maps and Yelp, with handy tips for parking and sneaking past the fence. Oh, Los Angeles, I love you. Even with light Sunday afternoon traffic, it took me over an hour to get down to San Pedro, shoot south on Pacific Avenue to the shoreline, and park on the corner of Pacific and Shepherd. I turned the truck off and leaned forward to peer over the dash. You couldn't actually see Sunken City from the street. It was pretty well hidden behind a stretch of perfectly normal-looking houses. The only clue from this distance was the tall, wrought-iron fence that ran along the back of those properties to keep people away from the wreckage. I closed my eyes to concentrate and pushed my radius outward. Almost immediately, I felt some kind of Major League witch magic go pop. I wasn't sensitive enough to know what kind of spell I was breaking, but it felt a lot like the one at Griffith Park, which in turn had seemed similar to Kirsten's standard humans-go-away spell. Like the other one, though, this had a sort of sickly cast to it. I was guessing it was some kind of Lupari signature. Gross. I sat there for another 5 minutes, concentrating hard on my radius. If I felt the slightest hint of witch magic, or any magic, really, I was going to peel out of there and get help. But there was nothing. No active witches, no other spells. I looked at Shadow. "You sure you're okay with going back there?" I asked her. She actually licked her chops, obviously hoping we would get a chance to revenge maim someone. What a cliche. "Okay, then." We got out of the truck. Shadow was on high alert, ears and nose twitching as she surveyed the area. "How do we get in?" I asked her. She immediately began trotting down Shepherd Street along the row of houses. I started following her, then stopped. Shadow paused, too, and turned to me inquiringly. "What happened to the people living in these houses?" I asked, gesturing at the row of buildings that faced back onto Sunken City. "They were all inside the humans go away spell." Shadow tilted her head at me, which meant she either didn't know or the answer was too complex for her to communicate with body language. But she made no attempt to stop me as I started up the walkway of the nearest house. I rang the doorbell, but nothing happened. I put my hand on the knob, and it turned. A dozen different scenes from horror movies flashed through my head, and I pictured myself opening the door on a neck-high pile of dead bodies. I cracked the door open a few inches. "Hello?" I called. The house smelled a little musty and closed up, but there was no hint of eau de decaying bodies, a scent I was unfortunately very familiar with. I stepped into the house, knife in hand, and Shadow barreled past my leg so she could check it for threats. I waited in the living room for her, but I didn't expect her to find anything. It felt empty. When Shadow returned, wagging her tail, I wandered into the kitchen and found empty takeout trays stacked on the counters. Not cheap fast food, but heavy foil or cardboard containers that bore the logos of some of LA's nicest restaurants. I followed a hallway to the bedrooms and found that the beds were still made, but topped with sleeping bags. Each room had at least one duffel bag. I went through one of them, but it contained only clothes and a handful of toiletries, shampoo, deodorant, toothpaste. I held up a handful of clothes to Shadow. "Were the Lupari witches staying here?" She didn't bother to sniff, just licked the air in front of her face. They must have left in a hurry after Shadow and Owen had escaped. "What would Jesse do?" I asked myself. The answer was obvious. He'd be thorough. So I painstakingly went through every single duffel bag, hoping they'd left behind something about where they planned to start the wild hunt, or how to stop the spell itself. But I found nothing other than clothes and toiletries. No personal items, no maps or diaries, no discarded burner phones. There was nothing else of interest, so I checked the neighboring house. It contained more or less the same situation. One by one, Shadow and I searched all 7 houses on that stretch of Shepherd Street, counting sleeping bags. Every time I opened a new door, I was afraid that this one would reveal a pile of bodies, but it never happened. There were 21 sleeping bags, but no signs of the house's actual owners. "What did they do with them?" I asked Shadow. She just wagged her tail slowly, the Vargas equivalent of a shrug. "Okay, how do we get past the fence?" Shadow led me between the houses to a place where 2 welded chunks of fence were supposed to meet. A whole 12-foot section of fence had been detached and tipped forward onto the ground, and there were dusty lines on the metal where truck tires had passed over it. This was how the Luparii had gotten supplies in and out of Sunken City. Shadow led me over the downed fence, past some tall grass, and I could see scratches in the dirt that had probably been pallets and tents holding supplies. They'd taken the time to pack this stuff up, leaving clothes and other replaceable items behind. We wove along a little path in the grass that had obviously been made by feet rather than a machine. It looked old, and I realized this wasn't a Luparii addition. This was the path that hikers used to get to Sunken City. Then we went past the tall grass, and suddenly there it was. It looked as though a giant had picked up several concrete buildings, crumpled them in his hands, and flung them onto the jagged side of a cliff. And then some pretty spectacular artists had done the decorating. It was kind of breathtaking. I understood why hikers and sightseers continued to sneak in here, despite the potential for injury or trespassing tickets. I had never been to Stonehenge, but something about the formation of the concrete chunks reminded me of it. A humongous visual marvel that had been simultaneously created by humans and by nature. I wanted to take photos, to climb up and down the structures and admire the graffiti. But that wasn't why we were there. Shadow was already moving, leading me down the inclined path toward a formation that looked like a giant letter T, just like Owen had described. There was nothing on the top, but I could see scratch marks where the metal bars of the cage had dragged. "This is where they kept you?" I asked. She wagged her tail. "Do you see anything they might have left behind?" She lowered her nose to the ground and wandered away, looking for clues. I wandered a little myself, but the only thing I noticed was straw scattered around, likely by the breeze coming in off the ocean. It didn't look like the tall grass or anything native to the coast. It seemed like the kind of thing you'd feed to horses. "Shadow?" I called. The Barghest trotted back to me. "Were there horses here?" I asked. She took off, which surprised me, but she just led me to a different spot on the cliff's edge. I peeked over, and the reek of horse poop hit my nostrils.
Ugh!
But I made myself look back over. "That is one big pile of shit," I said aloud. Shadow didn't laugh. Every Bargist's a critic. It looked like a lot of poop to me. But I didn't know enough about horses to determine how many would have been required to create such a mess. Probably however many they were planning to use tonight for the wild hunt. This was not good. Shadow's nostrils flared, and she wandered off again, leaping to the top of some of the stone structures. The whole area was wildly uneven, peaks and valleys created by concrete, mounds of dirt, fallen trees, and decades of wind. I picked my way down to the bottom of the U-shaped valley, checking the crevices for scraps of paper. There was some trash, but it looked like the kind of things teenagers might leave, cigarette butts, the occasional soda cup or beer bottle. I sighed. There was nothing here. It was pretty and interesting, but this had been a huge waste of time. I turned to climb back up, but my thoughts shifted to Jesse. It was kind of surprising that he hadn't called back by now. We'd already been there for over an hour looking through the houses, and it had taken us an hour to get here in the first place. I pulled my cell phone out of my pocket and checked the screen. I only had one bar, and even as I looked at the screen, it faded away, returned, faded out again. Shit. Suddenly, my screen lit up with a bright red circle. I squinted, adjusting the angle of the phone, and realized the glow extended from a small dot. And it was moving. What the hell? Could phones get viruses? But then the little red dot slid to the bottom of the screen, went down my wrist, skimmed over my arm, and stopped on my chest. Chapter 37. My insides froze. Shadow? I called, wondering if I could duck behind the nearest concrete chunk before whoever it was got the shot off. The Bargast had been standing on a massive horizontal chunk of concrete about 20 yards away, but she turned to hop down, and a voice boomed through the air, courtesy of some kind of megaphone.
Stay on that ledge, Bargast,
said a male voice with a French accent.
Or we will shoot her.
I heard Shadow snarl, her nails scratching on rock as she shuffled anxiously, but she didn't come closer. I was still thinking about moving away. I had the bulletproof vest, after all, when two more dots joined the first. One of the three slid up my chest. I couldn't follow its progress past my collarbone, but I figured it would end up somewhere around my forehead. The tall grass at the top of the incline seemed to ruffle, and a man appeared on the dirt path, making his way down toward us. He looked to be about 60, but I'd lived in L.A. long enough to know well-preserved when I saw it. He was probably upward of 70. There was a sound amplifier in his hand, but no weapon. He didn't need one.
Miss Bernard,
he called as he approached me.
I thought it was time we spoke in person.
I expanded my radius to get him inside it sooner and felt the immense tug of a powerful witch. A Lupari witch. He stopped about a dozen feet away and stood to the side, staying well out of the line of fire.
So good to finally meet you,
he said, as though we were at a fucking college mixer.
My name is Aldrich.
The name rang a bell. You're the head of the Lupari, I said, a little awestruck. He had come himself? In person? Don't you have minions for this kind of thing? He gave me a pained smile.
Come now, Miss Bernard,
he said cheerfully.
You don't think I'd miss the opportunity to lead the wild hunt?
Plus, squashing your insolent enemies doesn't carry the same weight if you have a lackey do it. The smile faded from his face.
Really? You should be honored,
he said.
It shows great respect to the soon-to-be former leaders of Los Angeles that I came for them in person.
I snorted. Yeah, that's just what we've been feeling these last few days. Respected. How did you know I was here?
You tripped the spell I had placed around the houses. When I stopped feeling my magic, I knew you must have arrived.
Stupid, stupid. Served me right for not learning enough about witch magic. Carl Schmidt's house, Noah's kidnapping, and now this? I was getting really fucking sick of these guys setting traps in my own damn city, and even sicker of falling into them. I had underestimated these people, which was stupid. They'd spent 3 years preparing for this, and at least part of that time watching me. Of course they'd had contingency plans in place. So why am I not dead? I said bluntly.
Because in this moment, I do not desire your death.
Oh, goody. We were going to play word games. So what do you want? He smiled mirthlessly.
They did tell me you were direct. I want to go for a car ride, young lady, but first I'll have you remove your knife belt and vest and toss them aside.
I don't think so. He must have been wearing some kind of communication device because he just said,
Roland,
and a chunk of dirt kicked up 6 inches in front of me.
The next shot will go through your left upper arm,
Aldrich said in the same maddeningly calm tone.
After that, your right upper arm, then each hand. At that point, I may lose my temper and simply let you bleed out. But who knows? You'll certainly be incapacitated enough for us to do anything we want.
Gritting my teeth, I pulled my T-shirt over my head and unbuckled the strap of my knife belt. I could hear Shadow whining and scratching behind me, so I called, "Stay, Shadow!" I tugged at the Velcro straps of the vest, ripping them apart harder than I really needed to. Aldrich watched me pull the vest over my head, but he didn't smirk at my skin-tight tank top.
"You may put your blouse back on,"
he said, as though he were being hugely generous. I scowled, but picked up the shirt and slid it back over my head.
"Toss me your cell phone,"
he instructed. Crap! He could use that to text someone as me. I thought about dashing it against a rock, but Jesse could track the phone. As long as I had it turned on, I had a lifeline. Aldrich turned his body sideways and held out a hand for me to walk up the path.
"After you, stay 6 feet away from me, please, or Roland might grow uneasy."
As I started up the path, Aldrich glanced at Shadow and yelled,
"Bargest, I'm leaving behind the watcher. If he does not call every 20 minutes and tell me you are still on that platform, she dies. If you get off the platform, she dies. Sit, if you understand."
I couldn't resist looking at Shadow. She looked terrifying, literally drooling with rage. But she sat. Only she did that insolent dog thing where her back haunches barely skimmed the ground. "I'll come back for you, Shadow," I called. "Me or Jesse, okay?" That made her relax into an actual seated position. She licked the air in front of her.
"She seems to respond to you,"
Aldrich observed, like he was doing a clinical study.
"Interesting."
He turned his back on Shadow and motioned for me to continue up the hill. Aldrich directed me past the downed fence and through the path between houses. There was a strange-looking black Mercedes waiting at the curb, shorter than a limousine, but longer than a sedan. As we approached, a uniformed male driver climbed out and rushed to open the door.
"After you,"
Aldrich said, gesturing me into the car. I balked. The one thing everyone always says about kidnapping is don't let them take you to a second location. Don't get into the windowless van, or, in this case, tinted luxury vehicle. But the driver pulled a Glock out of a side holster and stood with it pointed at the ground in front of us. The implication was clear. I climbed into the car. It was definitely the most luxurious vehicle I'd been in, all plush leather seats and glossy fixtures. There were two sets of seats in the back, and they faced each other for conversation. Aldrich slid into the seat across from me, his knees cracking a bit. Before I could come up with a decent plan other than punching his stupid face, a hard-looking man with pale eyes and hair opened the opposite door and slid onto the seat next to me. Neither of them buckled their seat belts, so I didn't either.
"Miss Bernard, this is Roland, my bodyguard,"
Aldrich said politely. Roland didn't speak, or deign to look at me. He simply adjusted his suit coat in a way that fully displayed the handguns he wore on shoulder holsters. "You know," I said conversationally, "only a few years ago, you'd never see guns in the old world. They were considered
uncivilized.
You don't strike me as a particularly civilized person,
Aldrich responded.
Personally, I happen to agree that they are gauche, but unfortunately that seems to be what you bring out in people. Why did you tell the bar guest you'd return for her?
I blinked. Excuse me?
You told the bar guest you'd come to get her. You or Mr. Cruz. To what purpose?
So she wouldn't be as upset, I said. Did he really not understand the concept of lying to make someone else feel better?
Why does it matter if she's upset? She's a monster.
I gave him a look. Well, isn't that Dr. Frankenstein calling the creature black? It was his turn to say,
Excuse me?
Obviously, I had always expected to hate this guy, but even so, I was really starting to hate this guy. Forget it. Could you just tell me what I'm doing here? I was back on script, which seemed to put Aldrich at ease.
I want to make you an offer.
I probably should have seen something like that coming, since I wasn't dead and all, but that genuinely surprised me. You want me to work for you?
Don't laugh.
He said it politely, but with an undercurrent of, Seriously, I'll fuck you up if you laugh.
This is a very real offer.
Okay. I forced myself to take a deep breath. What would be in it for me? I said carefully. He smiled.
Better. As you said, I'm deeply interested in squashing my insolent enemies. One way to do that would be to terrorize your city with the Wild Hunt, an option that's certainly very appealing.
He waved one hand.
Then again, I have already gotten so much of what I want. Petra is free and has learned the cost of her mistakes. The city leaders have been embarrassed. Perhaps it would be enough if their prize null defected to the other side.
I stared at him. He wanted me to trade myself for everyone he was planning to kill. The idea was horrifying, but at the same time, what was my happiness compared to the lives of hundreds of people, many of whom I considered friends? It might have been a very tempting offer, if I believed for one second he'd stick to it. I glanced at Roland to see what he made of all this, but he didn't seem to have moved. As if reading my mind, Aldrich said,
You're thinking I would go back on my word, because I would need to prevent them from coming to save you. But I'm not talking about a kidnapping, Miss Bernard. There would be no manacles, no chains. I'm talking about you leaving them of your own free will. You can even say goodbye, if you like.
He shrugged.
We could be on a plane or ship this evening, and you can start a new life working for me in France.
Doing what?
Why, the same thing you do now, but on a much larger scale.
He smiled in an indulgent, grandfatherly way.
The world is changing, Miss Bernard. 400 years ago, the Vampire Council fell, and the old world has had to make do without leadership. But as technology advances, we need better strategies to remain hidden. We need new leadership. A new council.
The Luparii, I said.
That was why they wanted so much power. They were literally going after world domination.
Well, old world domination, at least. I would have laughed if it weren't so fucking terrifying. You want to be... what? The new government?
Someone has to lead, he said patiently. Now is not the time for supernatural factions to be divided. Now is the time for working together.
Now I did laugh. Says the guy who came here to kill a bunch of us.
But you can stop all that.
He said, so serious that it scared me. Well, scared me more.
All you have to do is say yes.
I stopped laughing.
What's to stop me from running away once we get there? I asked. I wasn't even sure if I was just playing along now, or if I meant it. He looked as if he'd expected the question, but was still disappointed by it.
Do you have any idea how easy it would be for me to have Mr. Cruz killed? Or Mrs. Hayne? Hell, I've wanted to kill Will Carling for quite some time. And I've had people in this city for years. If you tried to run, how long do you think it would be before your friends no longer drew breath?
I tried to keep my breathing even, to keep the stricken look off my face. Why me? I said. There are other nulls.
None as powerful,
he replied.
And you've proven quite resourceful.
I killed Killian and Sabine, I pointed out.
And if you hadn't, I likely would have, he said casually. Once we understood your inherent worth, Killian was instructed to take you alive. Instead, he planted a bomb in your vehicle.
Aldrich shook his head.
Sloppy.
I had a sinking feeling in my belly. What do you mean, my inherent worth? He shifted in his seat.
Oh, pardon me. The deal I'm offering isn't only for you. It also includes the child you carry.
Chapter 38. I was too shocked to respond. How did they know about the baby? How did they know about the baby? Jesse, the twisted slumber. They'd taken it out of his brain and then pretended not to know.
Of course, I can see why you might be hesitant to accept an arrangement of this nature,
Aldrich said, smoothing non-existent wrinkles from his pants leg.
But please understand, you will not be a prisoner in a castle tower. You will have minders, but you can come and go as you please. Most importantly, your child will want for nothing. She shall have money, and doctors, and nannies. Anything you need. Anything the child needs. All you have to do is work for the Lupari cause.
For a moment, I tried to picture it. Having the baby in a foreign country, surrounded by strangers paid to be there. Endless resources, endless security. And none of the people I loved. They would probably never know what had happened to me. And if I say no? Beside me, Roland made his first noise of the car trip, a quiet scoff. Aldrich leaned forward, looking incredulous.
If you should make that mistake, the Wild Hunt will ride tonight, as planned, and many, many people will die. No humans will be armed. So Mr. Cruz may survive, but consider the many who will be lost. Our world will see Los Angeles fall, its leadership crumble.
I had to clench my teeth to keep from screaming at him.
Then you will still come back to France with me, he went on, and spend the next, 8 months as a prisoner. After the baby is born... Well, an uncooperative prisoner is of no use to me.
He gazed at me with a look of pleasant inquiry. I see. Despite my best efforts, my voice came out shaky, goddammit. I took the time for a couple of deep breaths, forcing my fists to unclench. Finally, I said, You're not leaving me much of a choice here. His smile was almost sympathetic.
I understand, of course, that you may be inclined to lie now and promise cooperation you don't intend. That's what Roland and some of my other employees are predicting. But I have faith in your ability to do the right thing for your child.
He held up my phone.
So, I'll make this very easy. Call Mrs. Hayne and Mr. Carling. Hell, call Mr. Cruz. Tell them you're with us now. And I'll drive you straight to the airport. Give them any hint that it's involuntary, and we'll go with Plan B. You will spend this evening on our airplane, locked up in the cargo hold, where you will be safe and out of the way. while the Wild Hunt decimates this ghastly mess of a town.
I looked at the phone in his hand for a long moment. I didn't have to fake the tears that began to spill down my cheeks. This was just ridiculous. How could this old man with his fancy car and absurd accent get to have power over me? He was batty as fuck. I won't say that I made a choice because I never really had one. I took the phone, looked Aldrich straight in the eye, and said, "You've got a deal. But I want to make the hardest call first. And that's Jesse." Aldrich nodded, waving his hand and relaxing back into his seat. I dialed the phone. Roland didn't appear to have moved, but something about his body language suddenly screamed, "On alert!" Jesse answered on the first ring, traffic sounds in the background.
"Oh my God, Scar, where are you? I've been...
I tried to make my voice sound as calm as possible as I cut him off. I was not going to cry on the phone, goddammit. Aldrich wouldn't get that out of me.
"Jesse? Listen."
He heard my tone and went dead silent. "I love you," I said simply. "I'm sorry it took so long to... but I love you." Aldrich's eyes narrowed, but he wasn't sure where I was going with this yet. I held my hand up to signal that everything was fine, that I was getting to it. And then I leaned as far toward the window as I could and said into the phone, "I'm in a long black Mercedes on the corner of 7th and Pacific." For an old man, Aldrich could move fast. He ripped the phone out of my hand and slapped me across the face. I lunged across the seat after him, but Roland was instantly on top of me, slamming me back against the seat and fastening my seatbelt to keep me in position.